Well, my next guest is a Chicago entrepreneur who started up businesses in several different fields, including solar energy. His company, SoCore Energy, right here in Chicago, was recently sold to Edison International. Pete Cadens has now moved on to a new industry. He's dove headfirst into cannabis. He's the director and CEO of GTI, Green Thumb Industries, a company whose mission is to provide safe, effective, and therapeutic medical cannabis nationwide. Pete had a lot to learn about cultivation licenses, doses, dispensary regulations, and of course, marijuana. Cadens is also a philanthropist who sits on several boards and is the chairman of the board at Streetwise. And he is my guest tonight at the big table. Pete, thanks for being here, man.
Justin, thank you so much
good
for
to
having
see you.
Me.
You All right, too. I'm interested in how you've had such a varied career as an entrepreneur here in Chicago. You've been involved in startups. Obviously, the one the SoCore Energy, you get a lot of buzz for that. What drew you to cannabis, the industry, and getting involved in a new business in this field?
Right. Well, I like to invest and spend my time in themes that I think make sense and that have a future. And so in 2007, when I started SoCore Energy, the theme was clearly, perceiving that Obama or Clinton would be the next president, usher in a Democratic administration, incentives for renewables, and just a changing of the guard in terms of how people think about, energy. And so I invested heavily in that theme. And then, when I sold that company, stuck around for 2 years and decided to, make a switch to the cannabis space, again, it was about the theme. And the theme here is this. It's very simple. Cannabis is at the intersection, at the crosshairs of two really dynamic and interesting issues in this country, chronic epidemics, I would call them. Number one, the epidemic of underfunded governments, chronically underfunded governments. And number two, the opiate epidemic. Both that are causing major problems in this country. And so that combined with my, I thought it was a good theme to invest in. That combined with my anthropological fascination with poverty and how the war on drugs has impacted poverty,
it was
a no-brainer.
Okay, back up right there. That's explain that. Why do you have a anthropological interest in poverty?
So for many, many years, both my wife and I have been involved in the poverty space. And when you sit down with people who are poor or homeless or on the verge of homelessness, what you realize is, I used to think probably when I was a little younger and more naive that if you're poor or homeless, you were some permutation of mentally ill or addicted. And there were probably a couple other buckets, but I didn't pay too much attention to those. But there's this whole other big bucket of people, which I think many of the people in Chicago are plagued by, and that is African-Americans or Latinos who somewhere dating back to maybe the Reagan era were convicted of a nonviolent drug crime. And as a result of that, are still kind of a part of this generational poverty. Can't get out of poverty, can't get a job, not even bagging groceries. And so I took a very anthropological interest in poverty. That's why I became chairman of the board and very involved in Streetwise and the CARE program and other organizations, because I realized that the most important thing for these people is just a second chance, just someone to say, there's a purpose for you in this life, and we're going to give you that purpose. And instead of dealing illicit drugs or instead of doing other nefarious things that could get them in jail again, let's incorporate them into our culture. Let's incorporate them into our working environment and ecosystem. Let's get them real jobs that matter. And that's why I'm such a big believer in the reform.
I mean, it's such an interesting dichotomy because you think about the fact that, yes, the war on drugs has definitely plagued generations of people in this city and other places. But there also could be an argument that the drugs themselves had a lot to do with that. Getting into a industry that's trying to regulate itself that has, found its way to ruin people's lives. I mean, it's a difficult play for someone who, like yourself, who cares.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in fact, I don't even drink.
I know.
Yeah, right. I'm pretty much a teetotaler. But, I think there's a reality. And I think one of the fundamental problems we have here in the United States is sometimes we deny reality. The reality is marijuana is a $3 billion industry in the state of Illinois. The reality is it's a $60 billion industry nationwide. We aren't going to stop it. We can try as hard as we want to talk about abstinence. And abstinence would be the best solution. But the reality is that's not going to happen. And so rather than continuing to play this cat and mouse game and having illicit drug dealers deal to 15-year-old kids, who text them and they show up at a corner 5 minutes later, let's regulate it thoughtfully. Let's tax thoughtfully. Let's create employment opportunities. The marijuana space employs about 200,000 people today. Mm-hmm. And so I just think it's a better alternative than the existing reality.
you know, for you, and I think about the world, you know, as we know it. I mean, you kind of mentioned it, just the idea of politically seeing it advantageous to get into solar energy at the time when there was a new president coming in and so forth. The president that's in now and the attorney general, they've gone out almost out of their way to say that we are going to bring marijuana in all of its forms, whether it's regulated, you know, in Colorado or medical marijuana plans throughout the nation, to a halt or to a little bit more scrutiny from the federal government. I mean, how does the politics of today affect the kind of work that you are in?
Yeah, so you're right. I think that the Trump administration, and in particular Jeff Sessions, and some of the things he has said have scared people in the industry. As a business person, I kind of don't mind that, actually, because when people are scared, I think there are opportunities. But yeah, I mean, does it worry us a little bit, some of the stuff the session says? It does. But I think, again, you got to be really pragmatic and you got to be very adaptive as an entrepreneur. And the pragmatic reality is 89% of people support medical marijuana. And those are real polls from Gallup and, you know, Quinnipiac University. 60%, roughly, give or take a couple percent of people agree with adult use or recreational use of marijuana. This is a train that has left the station long ago.
Right.
I just don't think the Trump administration is going to do anything to stop that train. I think it would be politically very unpopular. And so some people might say you're taking your chances. But I don't think the opportunity for us would exist if it weren't federally illicit as it is today, if we didn't have people like Jeff Sessions who are hawkish on a war on drugs.
Pete Cadens is my guest. He's the director and CEO of GTI Green Thumb Industries. We're talking about the cannabis industry, Chicago entrepreneur. Let's take a quick break. And I want to come back and I want to talk about regulation, because this is a highly regulated field and industry. And it's not, I mean, we're here in Chicago. We're downtown on Michigan Avenue, and Chicago, Illinois has its own issues with medical marijuana. But you're talking, your company is not just Illinois. No. You have to deal with regulations set
all over the country,
all over different states, doing it all different ways,
yeah.
And have to find a way to navigate to be able to have a successful business. We'll talk about that. Pete Cadens, my guest in studio at the Big Table tonight. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the Big Table tonight, Pete Cadens. He is the CEO and director of GTI Green Thumb Industries. He's in the cannabis industry. I said this right before we went to break, that it's not Illinois. I mean, every time we have a conversation in Chicago about medical marijuana, we talk about the politics behind it, what's happening with the program. It's a very restricted program. We talked about it started with Pat Quinn. Now it's a different governor all the way through. But I think, you know, when I read your story and we talk about your company, you're not provincial in that way. You're not regional in the way that you're thinking about just Illinois. This is a nation. This is a countrywide program for you.
This is. We think there's amazing opportunity with scale, and unfortunately, just being in one market, you can't get that scale. But probably as important as that is, we think there's, unfortunately, I think the reality is there's enormous risk, what I would call stroke of the pen risk. On any given day, a governor, a legislature, a new governor can make a decision that can materially impact in a negative way the market opportunity.
You're not unfamiliar with, because you were in solar energy for, I mean, that's the same
concept.
We're
extremely familiar with that. In the solar space, I live that every single day. You know, incentives will be wiped out overnight when a legislature made a decision. So you have to have your finger on the pulse of the legislature and the governor and all sorts of political influencers. But to have that, you know, all that risk tied up in one market, us, doesn't make sense. Just, you know, logistically speaking. And then beyond that, obviously, we see the opportunity to scale and build brands nationwide. We're in four markets today. We're looking at three others where we're applying right now. We've applied in Pennsylvania. We're going to be applying in Ohio here in 3 weeks, and a couple other markets we're looking at.
So for people who are listening and don't necessarily understand the medical marijuana industry, the idea of you can't just open up a retail space in Maryland and be like, we're here.
No.
There are regulations, there are licenses, not unlike casinos. There's only a few slots and you bid for those slots.
This is an extremely difficult business. I always tell people it's two times harder, it takes two times longer, and it's two times more expensive than you can ever have imagined. Take your worst case scenario in terms of how much it costs and how much time it takes, and multiply times two, and that's what you get. Because, you know, the regulators, they don't want to screw this up. They don't want bad actors on their hands because then then their hands aren't clean and their program doesn't look good. And so they're very careful and they ask a lot of questions. There's a lot of due diligence. And look, the process of putting together a qualified application in a lot of these states, and we apply in states that are highly regulated. We are not in Colorado, for example. And there's good reason for that. And I can talk about that. But, you know, it might take $1 million and 9 months to prepare for to prepare an application. That's before you get a license, and you may not even get that license. There could be 700 applicants for 12 licenses.
As a businessman, as a startup, how do you prepare for that? I mean, how do you prepare investors or prepare partners or other people who are working saying, you know, it's going to cost all this money before we see any money?
Yeah. Well, luckily, my partner, Ben Kovler, established a pretty good track record. I was a passive investor with him when he started our Illinois business. And we got three of the five highest scores in the state here in Illinois in a very rigorous process. He proved that his team was capable of doing this. I just joined the team, kind of Johnny come lately. And I think the first thing, the way you prepare is you have an amazing team. We have the best lawyers, the best compliance folks, you know, in my opinion, of course. We have smart construction people. We have smart product managers. We have great horticulturalists. I mean, we put together the disciplines that matter to win.
I mean, to be in this business, and you just mentioned that, you give a little bit more of the scope of what you have to do. Because if you're talking about horticulturalists, you're talking about growing the marijuana. You're talking about project managers, you're talking about, or people in construction, you're talking about building out spaces for that growth, but also the retail space, and talking about, you know, even up to what you're doing. I mean, the idea of what the brand is going to be. And this is not, I mean, when I think about it, I automatically am like, medical marijuana dispensary. What a small, quaint, fun business. This is not. I mean, this is multi-million dollars, and what we think, this should be what you think about when you think about the medical marijuana industry.
Right. Well, so here's what I would say is, look at the alcohol business today. And in 10 years, I think the marijuana business is going to look very similar.
Do you think it'll be that quick?
I do. I do. I mean, look, it's already a $60 billion industry. Now, the fact is that $55 billion of that is illicit. But is what's going to happen is as more states come online. I mean, look, all these states, including Illinois, they have to be looking at the prospective tax revenue, especially Illinois. Frankly, right? Given our deficit and our pension issues and such here, you know, so they're going to look at neighboring states. We're bringing in 100, 200, 500 million to fund potholes, education deficits, everything else. And it is going to be impossible for them to turn down, in my opinion.
Pete, the question that comes to mind, and it's not unlike, I think about other industries, the alcohol industry you mentioned, but I think of casinos as well, that there always seems to be a pushback because illicit or former illicit product usually brings bad apples, and you mentioned bad actors.
Yeah.
The idea that there's going to be more possibility for illegal, you know, bending of the rules, regulation, not to be so flip with the word, but the mafia, things like that.
Yep.
But I mean, you can understand like why there's so much regulation involved, and you have to get it right. What makes you want to continue in that world when you know for a fact that that's not going to stop? That's not going to end. They're going to continue to. There'll be more. Every state that adds on is going to be like, you know what? That was good regulation. We should double that regulation. We good? We good? All right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's going to be a lot.
Yeah,
how do you foresee if in 10 years you're talking about such growth? I would think that also means in 10 years more headaches.
Look, there's going to be more regulation and on the marijuana space and all marijuana businesses. There's going to be more tax. We know that it's coming. You got to build it into your model effectively, and it's going to get harder and harder. But again, as sophisticated business operators who have kind of done this before and scaled other businesses, I look at that and say, good. And frankly, this is a plant that has the capacity to impair you. And so is regulation bad? Yes or no? I don't know. Maybe if there were more regulation in the alcohol space, there wouldn't be as many drunk drivers. Maybe there wouldn't be as many incidents at bars or domestic violence, as much domestic violence. And so I'm not quite so sure regulation is a bad thing. Frankly, look at the businesses I've been in. They've all been heavily regulated. So I think that the best entrepreneurs are adaptive enough to understand down the road, see around the corner, there's going to be regulation. We just have to account for it in our business.
Well, you hear a lot of small business owners, entrepreneurs, people who start up who will automatically say, it's too much regulation. The government is putting too much on me. I can't get, you know, we saw that kind of play out in the 2016 election, a real sort of both candidates, actually one candidate more than the other. another, going after that set to say we're going to remove the regulation. Mm-hmm. As a small business owner, or just a business owner, I'm hearing you say regulation's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, do you share the sentiment of some of your other entrepreneurs that the government overreaches or gets too much into the business that you're trying to create?
I mean, I think sometimes the government does overreach, but you know what? I guess if I had my druthers, I'd say I'd much rather be operating a state like Illinois with a restrictive set of regulations than a state like Colorado where anyone, an attorney, can get a license.
Why aren't you into Colorado?
Look, here's an interesting data point for the people who are listening in here. There are more pot shops in Denver than there are Walgreens, CVS, Starbucks, and gas stations combined. I mean, literally, you know, 600 pot shops. To me, first of all, from an economic perspective, that's a race to the bottom. Too much competition. Second of all, it's impossible to regulate. If you know, and even the governor Hickenlooper has admitted this is a social experiment. We prefer not to operate in markets that are social experiments. We prefer to operate in markets that are thoughtfully regulated. And because the bad apple can spoil the bushel. I mean, imagine a scenario where you know, a school bus driver who got in touch with the wrong cannabis product drives 20 kids off a cliff. I mean, terrible scenario. Imagine what that would do to the rest of the industry. And so we prefer to operate in spaces that are thoughtful and careful, so we don't have the bad apple spoils the bushel syndrome. We're not exposed to that as
right.
much.
Right. Do you see a future in which medical marijuana, when you talk about brands and you talk about how big this business is, that it is mirrors the world of alcohol, where you have domestic products like the Coors Light of marijuana?
Yes.
Yes. Miller Light, and you could get the craft beers and other things that are different?
There will be a continuum of marijuana, just like there is a continuum of product quality and alcohol. I mean, it'll be the IPAs and the Budweisers and the Natty Lights, and everything between. But the one difference I'd have to say that people should understand about cannabis is unique in that it can elicit very specific experiences. And that's the one thing. Marketing is all going to transition to experiential marketing. People today, they buy strains, and these strains have really stupid names, in my opinion, like, OG Kush and Golden Goat and this other stuff, but I think it's going to transition. I don't think people buy strains. I think they buy experiences. And cannabis can give you an experience where you're kind of giggly, having fun, maybe a little psychoactive, but can still kind of enjoy the moment and enjoy, your friends. Or if you want to be in the couch watching a television show.
So you'll see the brands reflect what the marijuana does to you.
Exactly.
Right. Well, interesting. Pete Caden's my guest, a local entrepreneur who is the director and CEO of GTI, Green Thumb Industries. We're talking about the cannabis industry, medical marijuana. Caden's also a philanthropist. He serves on the board. He's chairman of the board, Streetwise. We'll continue our conversation. I want to talk to you as well after the news about just your philosophy on running companies and trying to work around some of the things we just talked about when it comes to regulation, but just, what it takes to run a successful business. Pete Caden's in studio tonight. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Anna and David Posey, restaurant Elska, are going to be here. We'll talk about Nordic cuisine, Danish influence on American cuisine. That's the brand they're going for, Pete. That's
nice. I like it.
Pete Caden's in studio. He's my guest tonight, the Big Table, director, CEO of GTI, Green Thumb Industries. We're talking about the medical marijuana industry, but also just about startups and starting your own business, because, Pete, you've done this a lot. I mean, this would be your third successful business. And I'm intrigued. When you start a company or get involved in a company, this has already been was already out there. You need to start this from scratch. But what do you have to do to learn about? Because I know you, and I'm like, I don't think you were a huge marijuana aficionado. No. And so what do you have to do to get yourself prepared to enter a business like this?
Right. Yeah. I had used marijuana in the past.
This is your big Obama moment.
It's my big reveal. I did use marijuana in college. I knew a thing or two about it, but I certainly was not an aficionado in any way. And in fact, when I got into the business, I probably hadn't used the product in 6, 7, 8 years, something like that. But again, I invested in the theme. But the way you educate yourself, I mean, great entrepreneurs, and I don't think I'm great. I just think that, you know, I've learned from great entrepreneurs. Again, they adapt, they hire good people, they hire experts around them. That's kind of what I did. I hired experts in the disciplines that I thought would make us great. So you go out and you hire a great agronomist, someone who's got an agricultural or science background, who understands commercial agriculture, understands, who literally lives, breathes, eats plants, understands plants, talks to plants, and not cannabis plants necessarily, watermelons and tomatoes, but can adapt that skill to cannabis. Hire great marketers, hire people who understand consumer packaged goods. You know, so what I've been able to do, I think, as an entrepreneur is build teams of great people. I know very little. I knew very little about solar energy. Nothing. I mean, not an electrical engineer. I was, you know, still after 7 years of doing that, I knew almost nothing, I felt mm-hmm. like. But I knew enough to know who the right people to hire were on the team. And I'm a very scientific about the chemistry of the team. Like how the team comes together. And just because someone is an A player and a rock star and knows something and has an amazing pedigree doesn't mean they're going to fit into the chemistry of the team. So I really study that chemistry element of it too.
Is that's important for an entrepreneur when you're putting together a team? It's not just about who knows what, but it's about how they interact with each other.
That's right. I mean, look, it's analogous to any sports franchise. You know, not everybody in the team could be Jimmy Butler or Dwayne Wade or whoever, Michael Jordan, or whoever you want to use. It's got to be the people that rebound. It's got to be the people that play defense. Got to be people that you know, sit on the bench and serve as support staff. And so same concept here, and all the team just kind of has to mesh in order to win a championship.
How do you deal with motivation and inspiration in a field where, as you said, right before the news, that a sign of the pen can change incentives, can change the current direction of the business. How do you keep employees motivated with and out of that sort of anxious field?
Yeah. I think the best way to do it, I have a theme, a managerial theme called unwavering authenticity, which means you're just as transparent with people. They know that what you're telling them is the gospel. It's the truth. You're not hiding anything from them. And then they know that they feel included, they feel in the loop, and they feel like there's nothing you're trying to hide behind. And when you're very direct with employees, as I think you probably know I am, and you're very inclusive with the information, I think they trust that they know what's happening. And so, you know, our employees today, if something were going on from a regulatory perspective mm-hmm. that endangered our business, I wouldn't be trying
but
to hide it from them.
But that can go both ways. In the way that if you got, you know, you just said, you know, you like to look ahead and around the curve. And if yeah. around the curve says, this bad times are coming.
Yeah.
You know, is it the right move to, hey, all staff, everybody, bad times are coming?
Yeah. I mean, actually, there will be people who would debate me on this, but I think it is the right thing to do. I would much rather my employees. In fact, so when I sold my prior company, there was a lot of pushback on when we actually would tell them about the merger. And my push was, I'm going to tell everybody as soon as humanly possible, and which is what we did. Because, look, in a corporate culture, things have a weird way of spreading very fast, even when you try to contain them. And I've learned that. You know, it's like, you know, one person hears something, 10 people know something.
Yeah, right.
And so rather than try to pretend that it doesn't exist, I'm just going to go out and address it and face the scrutiny.
Is it difficult, and you mentioned corporate culture, is it difficult to apply the techniques that you've learned in corporate culture to an industry that just from the get-go, when you hear it, doesn't scream corporate?
No, because my view of corporate culture is not the same as most views of
what's
corporate
your view?
Culture.
Yeah.
No barriers, no artificial walls, no hierarchies, no crap, basically, you know, no dress code, no vacation time, no offices. You know, I just don't play those games because I think what those things do is they put artificial boundaries between people. And so my corporate culture is, you know, I hire people we trust and we trust you'll get your work done. And if you take a lot of vacation and you don't do your job, you're going to be fired. And it's very simple. It's a very kind of quid pro quo. Trust is implicit between the parties. And if you break the trust, you're gone.
Don't you run the risk? I mean, because you're not going to necessarily know in a job interview if people can handle that. And what I mean by handle that is that, you know, there are some people who come from corporate culture who are like, I need a dress code. I need a vacation plan. Yeah. I need to understand when my days are. You know, I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea that everything is just, there's no crap. They want the crap. How, do you have to suss that out before you add someone like that to the team?
Well, people interview with me and with the companies that I run. I run a little bit of a different ship. My approach is very scientific. I go literally all the way back in my interview. My partner, Ben, was just telling me today, he's like, how do you get this information out of people? You know, and so one of the questions, for example, I always ask people is, tell me about the worst thing or the toughest experience you ever had to endure in your entire life.
And not just your work life, your entire life.
Your entire life. Because what I've realized over time is that, you know what? People's experiences outside of the four walls of an office, their life experiences, they bring those life experiences and those biases to the table, and that impacts their work in our office. And so if I don't understand them as a human being, I don't go as far as junior high, you know, I can't really assess who is this person and how is their work going to be impacted by who they are outside of the office.
Right.
So I'm very surgical with that. And the interview process is long and arduous, and we ask people very tough questions. Like, for example, one of the questions I would ask a dispensary manager, someone who's handling a lot of cash, and it's a really tough question to ask, but is, you know, hey, look, if your best salesperson, or we call them patient care consultant or patient consultant, is, you know, siphoning $50 off of the out of the register every day, and you catch him on the camera, but he's your best salesperson, and half your patients or your consumers are going to leave if he goes, what do you do? Do you fire him? Do you keep him? Do you regulate him somehow? Does it set the precedent that everyone else can steal it too if you keep him around?
Right.
But there's no right answer necessarily. But I want to see people in writing explain to me how they walk through that process and how they think. And so we assess people very closely.
I mean, when I think about everything that you're telling me, and I'm glad that you are, because it's an interesting look into how, you know, the world of entrepreneurship works. Mm-hmm. You really are. I mean, your job at the end of the day is to create the right team to be able to and keep the team in the right sort of mindset to accomplish the goal of the company.
Yeah. My job, I've said to people for 15 years, priest, rabbi, psychologist, you know, manager, mentor, friend, boss, whatever. I mean, like the spectrum of things in terms of getting into the psyche of a human being, mm-hmm. studying them. I spend a lot of time, I doubt most of my people realize it, but I spend a lot of time watching the people who work with me, studying their every move, studying their nonverbal cues, because I want to get inside their brain and know how they think. And then look, the best entrepreneurs are chameleons in terms of how they act. You have to meet people where they're at. You can't manage all people the same way. Some people don't respond well to harsh criticism. Other people do.
You got to figure that out.
You got to figure that out. And that takes hard work and long hours of studying people, frankly. It's you know, not easy.
Well, I mean, part of the fun of having this conversation is that you have been, you know, when we were talking about doing this interview, you are currently in cannabis, which is fascinating to learn about. But you come from solar energy, which is another area that's fascinating. Before that, it was outsourced sales labor. But I always wondered in my head, I'm like, how does Pete jump from one area to another that have nothing to do with each other? Because when I think I'm going to school for journalism, I'm learning my craft, like there's a connection to what I've done. But the more and more we have this conversation, it gives me a better insight into business in the way that what you're selling is the fact that you can create a motivated team and that team can sell anything.
Yep. On a surface level, nothing linear about my career path. But when you study what I've actually done, you know, I always said to my wife, you know, she said to me now two times, you're leaving a company you founded. You know, how do you leave a company you started? Because I stopped getting up at 4:30 in the morning, jumping out of bed, being excited to go to work. That's how. And that's my rule of thumb. When I stop getting out of bed at 4:30, super excited to go to work, like more excited than anything else I do other than play with my kids maybe, it's over for me. I'm done. But again, what I do is there's a science behind building great teams and investing in themes that matter and then make a big impact on our world and have the potential to really scale. That's consistent between all the things I've done, even though the underlying businesses are not consistent.
You know, for you, do you run the risk as a challenge to stay motivated yourself? I mean, when you talk about getting up at 4:30 in the morning, do you run the risk of having a sort of a addiction to the idea of starting stuff?
I've been accused of that. I seem to have a 7-year itch. Every 7 years I could do something different. I'm only 1 year into cannabis, so I guess that would mean I have 1.5 years. So I got another 5.5 or 6 years, which I think is going to be enough for me to make this run really work and make a big impact. But yeah, I have a little bit of entrepreneurial ADD. There's always something, a next cool thing out there. This one, though, is so different in that we can literally revitalize urban cultures. We can literally change the dynamic of minority communities in this
country. How important is it? Because, you know, when you talk about solar energy, there's a social conscious part, the idea of renewable energy source, trying to help the planet. In cannabis, and you look all over the GTI website, and it's everything from, you know, socially conscious. This is an idea of helping people who are in pain. How important is it for you to be involved in what you consider to be socially conscious businesses?
I mean, extraordinarily important. I think that as an entrepreneur, you have a moral imperative to try and do good by doing well. I mean, I have a fiduciary duty to do well for my investors. I think I have a moral imperative to do good in our communities that we serve.
That's not a shared moral imperative. There's a lot of people who are in businesses.
A lot of people, I look at greed and avarice as some of the worst, facets of a human being. I think there's a way to seek and obtain compensatory benefit from starting a company or working as an executive in a company at the same time to make a big impact in the community. To me, I wouldn't jump out of bed at 4:30 in the morning if I didn't have both of those things aligned. I couldn't be, you know, selling widgets, and even if I was making a ton of money, I would not be happy with that. Doesn't strike me as interesting.
You know, when you talk about the idea of giving back, and you know, this is a very controversial industry, mm-hmm. in the way that there are several people, some text in that said, hey, I don't want regulated marijuana. I don't care what the benefits are. I don't smoke it. I don't want the elements around it. Everything that's involved with what we know right now as an illicit drug. What do you say to that when you're in the business? You talk about a moral imperative and running a socially conscious business where there's a lot of people who don't see it that way.
What I would say is that you already have legal marijuana. Again, $3 billion industry in the state. It's one of the 30 largest industries in the entire state. You're just ignoring the reality. And by ignoring the reality, where we're serving as a conduit to allow illicit drug dealers to deal to 15-year-old children. And what's better? Is that better? You know, I don't think it is. And I think providing a conduit to more tax revenue for the state, mm-hmm. revitalizing urban communities, employing those people who've been subordinated by the drug policies in this country, I think it's serving a much better purpose than having this thing go completely unchecked and playing a silly cat and mouse game with it.
Pete, as you said, you're only a year and a half into this, and you think about the work that you've done, not just with your companies, but what you've done on the boards. You know, do you see yourself, you know, having a home here in Chicago? Do you feel, yeah. I mean, you're a Chicago guy, entrepreneur. We hear so much about the tech world over here in downtown Chicago, the mayor putting more and more money into or support into burgeoning industries here. Do you see yourself as an entrepreneur, as a serial entrepreneur, a guy who is on his third company? Is this the right town for a guy like you?
Yeah, actually, I always get really frustrated. This morning, I was having breakfast with someone, and he told me that a mutual friend of ours who's a successful entrepreneur in Chicago had recently relocated to San Diego, and this is a young guy, he's 40 years old. And that really bothered me. And the reason it bothered me is not because I'm mad at this guy. Everybody does what's in their own best interest. But, like, you know, you have to give back to the community that gave to you. The network here in Chicago has been so amazing for me. People have been so friendly. Even when I was a nobody, you know, people took my phone call, took my meetings, and agreed to educate me and to give me advice for free. And I feel, again, going back to that moral imperative thing, I feel like I have a moral imperative to stay here, to perpetuate businesses, build them long term, and to give back to the community that gave so much to me. Now, may someday I, you know, be a snowbird and, you know, live 6 months a year in Naples, Florida, maybe. But I will always have a home here, and I believe that all the businesses I start will be here. And this is an incredibly conducive place to start businesses. You know, like, the cost of living is high in San Francisco, and everyone's an entrepreneur in San Francisco. People don't return your phone calls. Pretty much here, if you call somebody and say, hey, I'm seeking your advice, they're going to return your phone call. That's why I love Chicago.
Pete Cadence is the director and CEO of GTI Green Thumb Industries, an entrepreneur here in Chicago, and also a philanthropist. He serves on several boards. He's chairman of the board at Streetwise. Pete, thanks for being my guest tonight. Thanks for talking about
your
business.
Thank you so much, Justin.